For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. We don't do this very often, but I'd like to just go around the room. We have some people here that are newish, and maybe everyone doesn't know each other, so maybe just say your first name and one other thing about yourself, like this is your first time here, or whatever you'd like to say. I'll start. So my name is Laurel Ross. My ordained name is Gyoshin. You can call me Laurel or Gyoshin. And I welcome you all.
My name is Mike. Today I started a workshop. Very excited.
He had 45 seconds of instruction and he did it perfectly. That's the way we do things around here. Thank you. I may be exaggerating. It might have been 30 seconds.
But well packed today.
Thank you. I think you've gotten yourself a new job.
Right. Good evening. I've come off and on since 2014. I practice mostly in the park with Eric.
I'm Kayla. I've come here on my own for over 2 years. I guess that's about maybe 7 or 8 years. And I practice mostly over at Tom Lisa.
Welcome. What'd you think of all those frustrations? Pretty cool, huh? It's only on Monday night.
Dylan, I'm studying compassion, and I prefer gender pronouns to they and theirs.
I'm Suzanne, and I've been practicing since 2000, but here.
We'll sample it later. Well, that was nice. We should do that every now and then. So we're in the middle of the summer, almost at midsummer. And last week, I spent several days in the muckiest, buggiest sections of a big, hot prairie, bending over orchid plants. And I was armed with toothpicks and a clipboard and a pen and a measuring stick and a styrofoam square to put the toothpicks in. And we were pollinating the flowers of Platanthera leucophaea, which the English name for that is Eastern Prairie Fringed Orchid. So this is a gorgeous plant, but it is critically endangered. It's federally listed, so it's official, native plant of our prairie wetlands. And what we were doing was imitating the actions of hawk moths who used to perform this pollination for 50 million years before we did, but they did it at night. And so since like the mid-90s, this has been an annual summertime activity for me, and there's really sort of a small army of volunteers that do this all over our region, that is to say, northern Illinois-ish. So in that time, about 25 years, at this particular forest preserve prairie where I was working in Northbrook, the numbers of these plants have increased from 7 to over 180. So we're pushing 200. We're looking at that number 200 this year. And a major factor in this growth in their numbers is the fact that these plants are now making fertile seeds because of our successful pollination, our volunteer moth substitute crew. So I like to think of this pollinating as my patriotic activity because it always happens around the 4th of July. And these are iconic plants that are, they're emblematic of our magnificent North American landscape, especially the prairies and the plains. So this is all kind of interesting, I hope, but you might be wondering what this has to do with Soto Zen practice. And I just want to say, me too. That is actually the question that I am asking in this talk. And I may or may not offer you some clues to an answer to that question. So let me say just a little bit more about pollinating. And I brought a visual aid because you can't imagine how lovely this plant is. Here it is, Platanthera leucophaea. It is, see fringes, prairie fringed orchids, see the moth? That's what the moth looked like. He's down there with his tongue in the plant. Gorgeous, gorgeous plant. I'll leave it down here. Anyway, so I just want to say a little bit more about the process, because, and it will be relevant, I hope. So in May, we look all over for the plants. We have to find them. And we actually put cages on each one of them because deer love to eat orchids and lilies. So if you want to keep an orchid, you have to protect it from the deer. And then when the flowers emerge, right around the 4th of July, as I mentioned, we call out the pollinating troop, and we relocate each plant, and then we take some data. We have to give the height and count the leaves and count the flowers, and we write it down. This is what the Fish and Wildlife Service wants. They're in charge of the recovery of this plant. And then we use our toothpicks, which I am quite positive is the least expensive species recovery tool in the history of species recovery. And we poke it into each one of these little flowers. You can see there's multiple flowers on each plant. And we pull out the pollen sacs, and they stick to the toothpick, and we stick it into the styrofoam thing. We do that with each flower. And then we take the toothpicks that have pollen sacs from other flowers, and we touch the female parts. You sort of know the theory behind this, right? With the male parts, and we pollinate it. It's actually pretty amazing because if the pollen reaches its goal, It has a very sticky response. It sort of has a nice sticky little response, very sexy. So this year, as I was sort of immersed in this activity, I was thinking, this is just like Sesshin. This just feels like, this feels like practice. This what it the work takes real concentration, and there's a fair amount of discomfort, and there are very specific forms to be followed. Very specific. I mean, it's the federal law to follow these forms. It's mostly done in silence. There's what we call functional speech. You know, sometimes we have to say something about what we're doing to communicate, but it's mostly silent. And it's also mostly in community with other sincere practitioners, I would call them. You know, you have the experienced people solving some problems and giving assignments, and just like Sesshin, at halfway through, someone comes through with cool watermelon. Oh my gosh, we speared it with our toothpicks and scarfed it down. It was really great. So, you know, a couple people left before we were finished because they had a backache or headache or whatever. But mostly, we persevered in spite of being pretty darned uncomfortable. And I can't say it was blissful, but I can say it was a good way to get a glimpse of no thought and maybe even no self. I mean, your mind just settles down, and your hands and your toothpicks do the work, and you're a pollinator. You're not a personality. and you sort of get a glimpse of this. I always found a hard-to-grasp concept of shedding body and mind. It's like, just pollinate those orchids. So I say this, but I'm very confident that of all the people doing this, so at our site we had a half a dozen people doing this, but you know, in the region there are probably 100 people doing this. I'm pretty sure I'm the only Zen practitioner. So I may be looking at it a little differently than some of the other people, but as I was doing it, I was thinking, it felt like Zen practice, and then I thought, oh, I guess I've been trained to do this by my Zen practice. And then I thought, no, this is Zen training. That, oh, you're thinking too much. So it's like, stop thinking. But I am. I'm thinking now about practice and training and how our lives give us these endless opportunities outside of the Zendo, and also how practice and training can transform our lives. So so practice, so what is practice? So I love Katagiri Roshi's summary. There's sort of three admonitions about practice. He says, 1, continue under all circumstances. 2, don't be tossed away. 3, make positive effort for the good. So that's good advice in the Zendo. It's good advice in the prairie. Continue under all circumstances, even when it's 95 degrees and your back aches. Don't be tossed away by the mosquitoes and ticks and flies. Make positive effort for the good. Every new seed that forms because of our little toothpicks is a baby orchid. It's a baby orchid that has the potential to grow to adulthood, and that is what's going to save this species from extinction. It's sort of a big deal. So anyway, I like to think about Zen training as practice in fostering compassion. And so it's compassion. It's compassion for all beings, compassion for all sentient beings, however you think of sentient beings. So in this work, we grow our compassion for these dwindling orchids and compassion for the wetlands that needs the orchids to have its full expression of wetlandness, and compassion for the hawk moth. They're not extinct. They're going to come back as soon as there's enough orchids for them to get their own needs met. So it's a building of this compassionate world view. And, you know, it sort of changes you in a way that, you know, when you put your hands together in front of your salad, you actually feel something about that salad. So another aspect of Zen training is sort of fostering this gut level realization of, we always hear, being one with everything. I mean, truly being one with everything. It's real. It's true. It's hard to really feel it. But this kind of, when I do this thing, I actually am part of that orchid. I actually am part of that wetland. It's a physical process of being part of it, not thinking about the concept of being part of it. So I guess I'm asking myself, you know, so I'm asking all of us, so what is Zen practice? So, you know, this is part of it. We're come to this beautiful little temple on Irving Park Road, and we sit here together on a cushion, and it's wonderful, and it's important, and it helps us sort of understand what it means to be awake, but it's also living our lives, and the things that we choose to do in our lives are our other training. So I remember, I'll just tell you the story. I don't think I've ever told this story in here. I might have eventually told Taigen, but the first time I ever came to an all-day sitting here was, I've been coming to this place for 12 years, pretty close to when Ancient Dragon moved here. And I signed up for an all-day sitting, and then I got an email that said, you know, my confirmation, and it said that my job would be Assistant Tenzo. And I thought, oh, good, I'm comfortable in the kitchen. That would be great. And Hogetsu was Tenzo then. So then after the first period of Zazen, I was told, okay, report to the kitchen. And Hogetsu gave me all these jobs, you know, to wash vegetables and chop vegetables and, you know, all the stuff we do to prepare a meal. And I spent the entire morning in the kitchen, except for the Dharma talk. I got sent back into the Zendo for the Dharma talk, but all the rest of the time I was in the kitchen, and I was sort of shocked. It's like, well, wait a minute, I'm here for an all-day sitting, and I'm not doing any sitting. And I didn't even bring it up in Doksan because I was sort of baffled by it. And I actually wrote to a friend of mine in California who's a Vipassana practitioner. He's done some Zen. He said, well, were you a scholarship student? You know, I said, no, I pay the full fee. I was like, I don't know, I was just chopping. And it took me a fair amount of time to figure out that was my practice. It really, duh, when I think about it now. But so, you know, cooking is a pretty traditional Soto Zen practice. And you read Dogen, I mean, he talks about cooking. It's really some of the best stuff to read that he's written. And when you think about it, cooking is a really good thing for a practice because we have to do it all the time. And if we approach it as a practice, how rich can that be? You know, selecting the food, preparing the food, serving it, eating it. I mean, but it would be a choice to do that as a practice, to do it with all of our heart, to do it in that way. I mean, I have a friend who, it's going to sound strange, but it's really true. His spiritual practice, one of his spiritual practices, is making cookies. And, you know, he takes it really seriously. He does it, so every Tuesday, and he's a scientist, sort of a hotshot scientist in a fancy institution on the West Coast. But every Tuesday and Thursday at 3 o'clock in his office, he invites everyone from the institution for coffee for like half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever. He's done this for almost 40 years now. And every Monday night, he makes cookie dough. And every Tuesday morning and every Thursday morning, he makes cookies and he finds all these delicious recipes. And he serves it, and it's his gift to everyone in this institution. They come to his office, and they have coffee, and they eat delicious cookies, and they share with each other. It's a pretty nice practice. So anyway, there's so many ways to practice. if you decide to become an ordained, lay-ordained practitioner, you sew a rakusu, and every stitch is your practice. You know, before you sew, you offer incense, and you take refuge with every stitch of sewing your rakusu. And it is quite, and if you become ordained as a priest, you sew this enormous thing, which is a giant piece of fabric that you chop into many small pieces, and then you sew them all back together again, stitch by stitch. It's quite a transformative practice, not just for the fabric, but for the sewer. So there's role models everywhere. I mean, there's lots of people that came out of the San Francisco Zen Center, just for starters, that are sort of known for other things besides their zazen. So, you know, there's Ed Brown, the author of the Tassajara Bread book. He says, he's like this supreme food person. When you're cooking, you're not just cooking. You're not just working on food. You're also working on yourself. You're working on other people. But Jane Hirschfeld, fantastic poet. I can't say enough about her poetry. Her practice is poetry. She spent, 3 years at Tassajara and another 5 years or so practicing in residency. But she says, a monastery is a training place, but one of the traditional models for Zen practice is to go back into the ordinary world and ordinary life. So her ordinary life is the practice of poetry. Quite an extraordinary ordinary life. And Wendy Johnson, you know, gardener at Tassajara for decades, she wrote a great book on her gardening. And she says, working in the garden is also meditation, though not in the conventional sense of calming down, moving slowly and deliberately, and dwelling in stillness. On the contrary, I am often most alert and settled in the garden when I'm working hard, hip deep in a succulent snarl of spring weeds. My body and mind drop away, and I live in the rhythmic pulse of the long green throat of my work. That's her book is called Gardening at the Dragon's Gate. And the last person I'll mention from that whole crew is Natalie Goldberg, who I've been reading a lot of lately because I've been doing a lot of writing. So she practiced with Katagiri Roshi in Minnesota for, I think, 8 years. And she has written many books about writing practice, as she calls it. Her first book that sort of made her reputation, she's written, I think, something like 15 books, but her first book was called Writing Down the Bones, Freeing the Writer Within, Connecting with the Larger I. So she, in that book, she describes Katagiri saying to her, well, why don't you make writing your practice? If you go deep enough in writing, it will take you every place. So she writes every day, and as she describes it, she does it as a practice. So she's not like working on a novel. It's practice. And she says, writing writes. Write to connect with a big you, not the small you. So that's sort of interesting because we always think of art as being connected with talent, And I'm not sure exactly what talent is. I mean, is it an affinity? I mean, I do think there's such a thing as an affinity. So what do we really like to do? Maybe when we find out what we really like to do, that could be our practice. So the first time I wanted to go to singing camp. There's a singing camp in Vermont. I wanted to go to it, and I called them up, and I said, are there auditions? And they said, well, this is what we do to see if you're qualified. We just describe the schedule to you. So we get up at 7, then we have breakfast, then we sing for 3 hours, then we have lunch at noon, then we sing for 4 hours, then we have dinner, then we sing for 2 hours, and then after dinner, a lot of people get together informally and sing and play their instruments. And we do that for 6 days, and then on the 7th day, we perform all the stuff we've learned all week for an audience. That sounds good to you? You're qualified. It's like, okay, that's enough. You know, it's like, you like it. And then is that the way you choose your practice? I say this partly because I know people who do not have an affinity for Zazen. Have you ever had this experience of talking to your friends and saying, oh, you should do this thing. Come to the ancient dragon. You describe it to them and they're like, yeah, maybe sometime. You never quite pin them down to a time. And then they say, oh, yeah, I tried that at home. And it's like, it didn't work for me, or whatever they say, you know. Or, you know, I tried it, and good luck with that, you know. So, but a lot of these people, their practice is something else. At least some of these people, their practice is something else. So something like music, but it could be like car mechanics, or it could be bird watching. I know a lot of people, it's like very intimate with their birding practice. They don't call it a practice. And I mentioned this baking cookie. So, and I look at these people, and you know, I think of them as masters, as awake people. I mean, I see them practicing in this really sincere, authentic way that's not Zazen. It's interesting. It's interesting to me. So I want to say that in a few days, on the so today's the 15th, on the 20th of July, I am going to mark my 5th anniversary of being ordained as a priest here at Ancient Dragon. Some of you were at my ordination, but most of you were not. So that means it's the end of my 5-year commitment to practice as a novice priest here. And so I ask myself the question, well, it's the end of that. What is it the beginning of? I mean, I have no idea. And I'm not going to say, because I don't have an idea. I mean, nothing is changing, except somehow it seems like an opportunity to think about something beginning. So on the occasion of this, I want to take a minute and express my gratitude for the opportunity of practicing here these 12 years, and particularly these last 5 years. And Taigen has put me through my paces in various ways. And I just to express my enthusiasm for continuing my practice in lots of ways, including with toothpicks, and including at singing camp, and whatever else I can discover. So I'm going to end with a quote from Suzuki Roshi, and it's not from Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. It's another sweet little book. Do you know this? It's also collections of his talks. Not Always So. And he says, to be completely concentrated on what you do, that is simplicity. And the beauty of practice is that it can be extended endlessly. You cannot say that our way is quite easy or that it is very difficult. It's not difficult at all, but to continue it is rather difficult. Don't you think so? He said. So we practice, and to continue can be rather difficult. But we do. So that's my talk. And I want to say I would love to have questions or comments, but I'd also love it if you have other practices you'd like to share. I'd love to hear about those as well. One time Suzanne and I, oh, actually Dave was part of this too. We did this great practice of chanting for the Joffrey Ballet. And that was, we had to chant the Enmei Juku Kanongyo at the Auditorium Theater for real people who had paid a lot of money to see the Joffrey Ballet, and the chant was part of it, and it was quite a challenging but fantastic practice. I think of that as, every time I see you, I think of that just a little bit. Anyway, those musicians were very spectacular. Sincere practitioners, too. Okay, sorry, I'm rambling. Shall I turn off the tape? Okay, who has something to ask or tell? We have a little bit of time. I didn't go on too long. Yes.
Because when I go to the Bay Area, I have friends, and maybe we're not bird watchers. I'm not a bird watcher. They're not bird watchers. But when we get together, that's what we do, is we go bird watching. And so we were in this kind of swampy place, and I saw a bird called a sora, which is a very it's very private bird. You know.
It's a rail. They're the hardest birds to find. They're so secretive.
Yes.
But it has a big yellow beak, so you can see it, even though it doesn't know you could see it.
And so I am standing there, and I really got absorbed in watching this bird. And the guy that I was with, he was walking along the path, and he saw me, and he says, "Oh, there you are!"
and the bird left.
That was totally the end. I never got to see it again. I don't know, it's pretty funny.
So at this very minute, there is a family of sora rails. They're about this big. They're like little round birds. They're not skinny like some birds. And they're in wetlands. It used to be the Glenview Naval Air Station, and now it's called the Glen, and it's between Willow and Lake in Glenview, and there's a prairie in there called Kent Fuller Prairie. Anyway, there's a family of sora rails that you can see from the bridge because they don't know you're up there. It's really... So it's called the Glen. It's a big development. They developed the Naval Air Station, but they kept a piece of prairie. So you could go see them. They'll probably be there for another couple weeks. They're very cute, the babies paddling away. Suzanne.
So, yes, the chanting was my practice. I was very much a giver-receiver extravaganza. I said it was something that I retroactively put on my bucket list, which really only has one other item.
Oh, that's right. That's how you came to our Sangha. Oh, that's so nice. I forgot about that.
But there's a practice that I have that I did a little workshop at Kodumbara for one time, and maybe we do it here one time. I'm a photographer, right? I shoot with a macro lens sometimes for pleasure, not for work. And that's where you get really, really close on things. And then I could put on my phone.
Oh.
And so I got a whole bunch of them and we all went out with it. And I carry it with me, like, pretty much all the time. So that anytime I'm somewhere, like, I'm on a hike or something, and I'm looking around and I think, oh, it's not. So I came from California and everything was, like, spectacular, big mountains and ocean and kind of beauty with a capital B. And I moved here, and the first time I actually was supposed to go to a workshop with the poet you just mentioned, whose name just went over my head, Etan Sahara. And I had this thing with my ear and I couldn't fly. So I found this place, Beaver Island, in Michigan. I went there, I was camping, and I was kind of like, it's so flat. And it was the first time I had to stay here for my mom. And I brought out a macro lens.
Oh.
And started looking closely at little plants and got intimate with, like, there's all these, there's a whole university that studies on the ground, the different, what's the word, for plant communities. Anyway, so I've developed this practice with this macro lens of, like, when I'm sitting there and thinking, oh, you know, I think I know what I'm seeing, I just walk up to a plant, put that thing on it, and this whole other world opens up.
Uh-huh.
It's like, there's an insect in there that you have no idea, but the structure of the plant and this, like, whole mechanism that you wouldn't see opens up. And it's an especially appropriate practice in terms of Zen practice because the macro lens only focuses in this very thin sliver. So you're like holding this thing, trying to get close and trying to get focus, and there's something moving. So it's like kind of frustrating and kind of uncomfortable, but then there's this like magic that happens when you kind of, it's just, it's beginner's mind. I don't know. It's a lot of what you were.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Anytime anybody wants to be really uncomfortable, I'd be happy to do that. I have lots of extras.
So you were going to go to a workshop with Jane Hirschfield?
I was.
Oh.
Yeah, I was signed up for it at Pasmara. And I had this hearing last night.
She has a great book that's like How Poetry Can Change the World or something like that. It's really quite spectacular. Anything can change the world if you look at it in the right way. It's really interesting.
And even not being able to go to the
jam. Yeah, change the world for you. Michael, were you wanting to say something? I thought I saw you. I thought I saw you. No?
I was just thinking you first. I really appreciated your talk a lot. And I just was reminded of also being at Tassar during the summer work practice.
Oh, right.
During the practice period. And having a, you know, a hard time. A lot of work. You know? I remember one of my friends that I was on a dining room crew with. He was just constantly like, what is this?
The language being awake is really helpful for me. So it's sort of like you're either paying attention or you're not. You're either dozing through the whole damn life, or you're paying attention somehow. It doesn't sound like enlightenment is just such a laden word. It's like, wait a minute, you know, I'm not claiming that. But I can claim to waking up now and then and noticing things. It's like a good thing. I thought about you, though, because I almost put as a practice, I have a piano, and I have a piano tuner who has been tuning pianos for like 50 years. And when he comes to tune your piano, you like have to have a nice quiet house. It's like he's like so focused on this thing, and you just could watch him get into whatever that state is where he's tuning the piano, and he's not a human anymore. He's a piano tuner, and he listens to everything, and he tweaks, and he's just like, wow. The first time I ever saw him do it, I was like, when he left, I just sat there and thought about him for a long time. Wow.
As a child, we had a blind piano tuner.
A blind, yeah. 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 It's interesting work. Because you had talked about maybe wanting to be a piano tuner. Yeah. Other thoughts from the other side of the room or anywhere? Okay, well, great.